Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 115, I'm joined by Dr. Daniel Chow of University of California, San Diego, and Dr. Ali Khan of the University of California, Los Angeles, to discuss articles from the July issue of Retinal Physician. Topics discussed include chandelier versus traditional scleral buckling, heavy oils for tamponade and retinal surgery, macular buckle techniques, and suprachoroidal corticosteroid injections. As our separate shameless plug, I would like to invite anyone attending this year's American Society of Retinal Specialists annual meeting in Vancouver, Canada, who enjoys this program, to please try and attend our first ever social media and online content course for ophthalmologists. Sunir Garg, Charles Wyckoff, David Almeida, Ajit Curry, and I will be doing a 75-minute course on July 20th, Friday, starting at 1 p.m. For more details, feel free to contact me directly. It should be informational but approachable, and it will be a relaxed session. We hope to continue this in the years coming, so please try and swing by. We would love to see you. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two of our prior correspondents. First, from sunny San Diego, University of California, San Diego, Dr. Daniel Chow. Dan, welcome back.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me again.
And from Los Angeles, California, from the University of California, Los Angeles, Dr. M. Ali Khan. Ali, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Good to be back.
So we're here today to discuss the July issue of Retinal Physician. I picked out a couple of articles that we're previewing here in advance. We're recording this on June 20th, and this will go live online right around July 2nd, which will be when the articles are released on Monday and when this issue goes into print. So the goal, again, of these episodes, unlike our journal clubs, we're not trying to summarize or break down these articles. These are review-type articles and general opinion pieces, but just kind of to foment discussion and what discussion based on the articles. And then if you're interested, you can go check out the articles at retinalphysician.com. So the first article we're going to talk about is an untitled Controversies in Care, Chandelier-Assisted Scleral Buckle Surgery versus Traditional Scleral Buckle Procedure. Ali, just want to basically summarize what this article is about, and then we can actually talk a little bit about chandelier buckling versus traditional scleral buckling.
Yeah, I think this was a kind of a pro-con type of article with one side written by Dr. Ed Ryan from Minnesota and then the other by Dr. Jason Chu from Wills, discussing the pros and cons of doing scleral buckle surgery, either chandelier-assisted or quote-unquote traditional with, you know, the typical indirect. This issue seems to have arisen just because of the overall reduction in the number of primary scleral buckles and how that has translated to trainees being potentially less comfortable with the procedure. And thus the chandelier-assisted method using the wide-field viewing systems may be quote-unquote more comfortable or promote higher use of scleral buckle, especially in younger surgeons. So this article is talking about the pros and cons of each and why this may be a good thing or a bad thing.
So, and we're not going to take moral stands here, though you guys are more than welcome to take a stand one way or another on this issue. I think that there's nothing really wrong with either point of this argument, right? So, like you mentioned, Dr. Ryan kind of wrote this piece describing why it's important to be able to do this from a traditional standpoint, some of the disadvantages of chandelier buckling, and then, you know, just about emphasizing good exam practices to avoid the issues people may have with BIO-directed scleral buckling. And Dr. Chu kind of pointed out some of the realities of, as we said, people being more comfortable with indirect viewing systems under an operating microscope. So let's open this up for discussion. Dan, do you have a preferred method for scleral buckling? Does it change depending on the types of cases you do or if you're staffing a fellow? And what are kind of the advantages you see to what you prefer to do?
Sure. So I would say I do, when I have the option, I do actually really like the chandelier-assisted buckle. I think all the points that are made are definitely correct. I think part of it is that there are just less cases which I would consider a straight primary buckle for. Again, it's just like I think Dr. Ryan mentioned, or as the article mentioned, it's mostly these young patients with, you know, inferior detachments primarily. Usually they're myopic with a single clear visualized break, in which case you know you don't want to go into the eye to perform a vitrectomy. And the reality is that there's actually just not that many of these patients around. I remember in
San Francisco, we had a fair amount. I think it's usually driven by how, like, there's more Asian patients, there's more myopic patients. We had more than we had in San Diego. But again, these are few and far between. And so I think that I think there is a point in that there are just less instances to really refine your craft now, I think, with a primary scleral buckle, in which case then, in general, one just may not feel quite as comfortable with indirect ophthalmoscopy as definitely our mentors might have been. I definitely, felt that to be the case. And I think having the chandelier option is definitely a very nice backup in cases when it may be difficult to visualize the break, say there's a little bit of cataract, or maybe the patient is pseudophakic and you're considering a primary buckle in that case. So I do find that it allows you to, I definitely feel more comfortable in terms of my visualization of the periphery. Certainly if it's not available, then I think definitely I think using the straight indirect viewing system, I think, is definitely just fine and very usable. But I think definitely I feel like there's more confidence in terms of making sure I identify all of the breaks. And I think, of course, there's also that element of teaching, in which case I think when you're trying to teach someone cryotherapy, either for pneumatic retinopexy or for scleral buckling, the inability to visualize where exactly they're putting the cryo spot is obviously can be quite terrifying at the beginning, and this obviates that. But that would be kind of my general opinions on the article. I think one thing that is true, when I first started, the view is not quite as great as one might think, because you're using this chandelier light, which is not going to be as strong and can't be moved as you can with your light pipe. So there does need to be a little bit of tweaking depending on the positioning, and yes, you do need to avoid the lens in phakic patients, but generally I find it to be fairly safe and pretty easy to adapt to, especially with kind of modern vitreoretinal surgery training.
I have a couple thoughts, but I'm going to throw the same question to Ali. Ali, what do you prefer to do? Does it change depending on whether you're staffing or not? Does it change depending on the type of case you're doing? And why do you prefer to do the way you do?
Yeah, I think it for me, it depends on the kind of case. I think if I got a pretty solid preoperative exam, there's only, maybe one or two total breaks, I don't necessarily see the advantage of, per se, the chandelier-assisted method using the viewing system. Again, these are most likely, like Dan said, phakic younger patients. So if I feel confident in the view, I think using the quote-unquote traditional method is just fine. That's how we, Jay, you and I trained actually for the majority of our fellowship. However, there's like a ton of breaks noted preoperatively. If there's any issue with the view, and or the breaks are very, very small, like there's these tiny holes, or there's not a big obvious break that makes me confident, then I think that using the wide field viewing system is actually a benefit and might actually convince me to still try a buckle when I may have done a buckle vit just because I didn't see a clear break. So I think the case does depend. I think staffing matters as well. I think fellows, trainees, med students do like to be able to see. It is a cumbersome to kind of go back and forth with the indirect to kind of check cryotherapy and that sort of thing. Dr. Ryan mentions, this could be easily fixed by both people having an indirect. So I guess it just depends on how the OR runs and that sort of thing at your institution. But for me, it's still, I think the type of exam I'm getting preoperatively and the number of breaks I'm noting preoperatively is the one that kind of pushes me one way or the other. I use kind of a distilled down chandelier technique. I don't use, some people have talked about using an endo laser instead of cryo, transvitreally through the port to treat breaks. I don't necessarily, drain under direct visualization using the chandelier. I kind of push the chandelier aside push the viewing system aside and drain with a cut down like I do with the traditional buckle. And sometimes you have to check what kind of chandelier your OR has. I know with the DORC system, they kind of have a two-piece chandelier, which I think the view is not really good enough with one of the two pieces to do the chandelier method. So all of that stuff factors in for me as well.
Yeah, and I think that our similarities probably have to do with our similar training backgrounds. I'm with you. The reason I ask those questions, so for me, if I'm staffing, I'll usually prefer to do it chandelier because I can then, a lot of the, you know, again, the fellows are doing less and less cryo in general, unless they're doing a lot of pneumatics at your institution. There are less primary buckles. So with other faculty members or in general, they're doing less cryo. Taking that leap of faith to have the fellow do the cryo, make sure they're in the right position, they're cryoing the brakes, they're not too posterior. I like, especially if they have never done cryo before, I like to either show them or watch them. And so they can get a sense of where proper positioning is. Now, if they're further along in their training, then I kind of ask them what they plan on doing when they go out. So if they're going to be operating an ASC where opening a chandelier may be a cost issue and the other people in their practice aren't doing it and they plan to use indirect, then I'll do it whatever way they prefer to do it. If I'm operating alone, like you said, unless I have any questions about where the brakes are, I don't think there's a huge advantage to a chandelier buckle. Besides ergonomics sometimes, if you think it's going to be a longer, lots of cryo or you're standing and kind of torquing your body around trying to get the right angles, I think ergonomically, that was one thing we talked about in training, Ali, it can be nice to do it with the chandelier. And I do agree that cases, you know, it used to be the thing that people would say, right, is if you can't identify all the brakes, your pre-op exam is not great, you shouldn't do a buckle, that's when you do a vit. I think once you have a patient under local or general anesthesia and you put a chandelier, but that could be true of indirect too, you can get a very nice exam. And I've usually, Dan, you did mention the view's not optimal. It's not as good as a light plate, but it's pretty good. I mean, you can get, unless there's media opacity, you can get a pretty good view of the periphery. The only caveat is the view right under wherever you put your chandelier tends to be the worst. And so that's the final thing. If there's 360 pathology and there's really not a great place for me to put a chandelier and then get a good angle to like visualize my cryo right under the port, if I know there's pathology there, then I usually just prefer the indirect. It's less cumbersome. You know, nuts and bolts, you know, again, we'll move on from this quickly, but when we do chandelier buckles, Ali, we talked about this before, but you know, kind of the things that we've discovered that help. Dan, you mentioned that sometimes it can be, the chandelier itself can be stiff. I don't know if you guys are doing this as well. I've stopped taping the chandelier. So, you know, like we were always taught to tape it like an infusion line. I just hold it in the port and I never let go of it. I kind of hold it like a light pipe. And I find it's much easier to kind of direct it where you want with and avoid the lens and really not have that stiffness in the cable hindering you. And then I just make sure when I'm switching hands to depress or I'm switching hands to cryo that I pass it off hand to hand, so I'm never actually just leaving it loose and flopping around in the port. I think that's very helpful. I think using a valve trocar we've talked about is helpful, especially because, for example, the Alcon chandelier doesn't come with a valve trocar. It's a non-valve trocar. I think that when I agree with you, Ali, I think I personally don't do the needle visualization under the chandelier. I think I still do it traditionally. And one thing one of my colleagues here pointed out, which he does, I think a lot of times if you leave that port in, even if you remove the chandelier and you start torquing the eye to either suture or pass your buckle through tunnels, that port can pop out of the sclerotomy. And so actually what I've started doing is I quickly remove that port and throw a temporary suture and kind of keep that wound closed. So I'm not worrying about where that trocar is. And then, you know, if I need to visualize the end of the case, I can just, you know, reopen, put the trocar through the exact same wound so I don't make another sclerotomy. And that kind of avoids the flopping around of that trocar as you're torquing the eye around. And then Maria Baracol, what she pointed out to me once was useful as well to avoid vitreous prolapse is if you do an AC tap, even if you don't really need it for IOP issues, if you do an AC tap before you pull the port and suture it, that'll reduce the amount of intraocular pressure and reduce the amount of vitreous prolapse you get at the end of the case. Any other tips, pearls, Dan, and then Ali?
No, I think you pinned on all the highlights there.
Ali, anything else on this subject before we move on?
Yeah, no, I agree with the maybe lowering the IOP. You know, if you really tighten up that buckle before removing the port. And I've actually done it one time with a light pipe, Jay, instead of the chandelier. Just they opened just the individual light pipe because they didn't have a chandelier, and I held it sort of in my hand like you're describing. And I do think that's actually easier than sort of taping the chandelier as well. So it's a good tip.
Yeah, and I don't know the cost. I wonder if a light pipe alone is cheaper, the same, or more expensive than the chandelier. Because if you're using it that way, maybe the lighting is better because it's more focal. So if you're kind of doing your depressed exam, it's better. You just have to be careful about not inserting it too far, but because the chandelier kind of won't go past the point. I don't know if it'll just slide.
That was the only kind of challenge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just kind of was very careful about that. And obviously I had an assistant who kind of was watching it too. But, you know, the lighting was I thought better than the chandelier. It's just kind of having to hold it, you know, mostly out of the eye was a little bit uncomfortable after a while.
Right. And I think the final thing, that I think while I agree with Dr. Ryan, and I do think that people need to keep refining their indirect skills, I do think all of us, even, you know, we're not in the same generation as his generation, but even looking at the next generation, I think people are drawing less and less. People's exam skills are not as good in terms of indirect exam skills, and their exam skills using indirect system are getting better. I think from a realistic standpoint, if people are going to do buckles, their success rate realistically in this generation maybe has to be higher using an indirect viewing system than indirect. Now, you can argue the morality of maybe they should be able to do it the other way. From, but again, if they're not getting the reps, if this is the way they have better success, then, you know, as long as the risks aren't excessive, it maybe makes sense to do it this way. I don't know. That's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, Jay, I agree with you. I think it was a little bit of a different era in terms of, you know, I think the reason why, you know, the previous generation, their exam skills were so good is that, you know, scleral buckle was a primary way of repairing the retinal detachment, and that's where then indirect viewing became so critical. But, you know, in terms of, if you look at the outcomes, the number of surgeries that they're doing today, I think we are living in a different world where we have, you know, many more patients. There's more surgical volume. There's higher expectations. So it may actually be somewhat, you know, are we ever going to get, I think just in this, it's going to be very difficult for us to really have as much time. And I agree with you in terms of the repetition to really refine those skills, because, you know, in talking with my, you know, we're a lot of times we're kind of actively looking for good cases, which we can do, like, which is appropriate to do a primary buckle. And it just turns out that there's just not that many, I think, because of the versatility and wide indications for vitrectomy.
And to save you from getting eaten up by the flame war that will happen when people see this, Dan, I think there are people out there who could argue that almost any detachment could be buckled, and there are people out there who argue that no detachment should be buckled, and I think we're all kind of in between on that argument, right? And so I agree with you. There are cases that are better suited for buckling, especially for someone who's not an experienced, you know, Buzz Krieger-level scleral buckler. And I think most of the people in our generation, I agree, just to save you again, because I'm sure there's people out there who are going to listen to this and say, oh, but you could buckle this and you can buckle that. And it's true. You can put a buckle on many detachments. It's just a question in your hands, does one have a higher success rate than something else? So I do agree with you, though. Well, moving on, you know, the next article is called Heavy Oils in Vitreoretinal Surgery. Subtitle, Heavy Tamponades Have Utility in Managing Complex Retinal Detachment, by Dr. Rizzo et al. From Italy. Dan, let's talk just briefly about what they wrote about for heavy oils. Remember, none of these are approved in the United States at this point, but just talking about the principles they're talking about, and then we can have a brief discussion about it.
Yeah, so this was an interesting article. So the idea is that introducing now a third type of tamponade. So obviously we have gas, and then our silicone oils, which, as we know, are lighter than water, so they will float. And we have our two, you know, different viscosities, 1,000 and 5,000 centistoke. But the idea here is, especially in detachment, say with inferior pathology, or perhaps in PVR detachments, where perhaps a lot of that PVR milieu will settle to the bottom from dependent forces, is that we won't actually get as good tamponade in these inferior quadrants. And this is where this idea of, if we had a heavy oil whose specific gravity is higher than water, then it will actually sink, and it will also provide good tamponade inferiorly as well as superiorly. And that's essentially, I think, the main assumption for the utility of this, is that, you know, especially if there's PVR stimulants, say inferiorly, like it will tamponade and doesn't give them a chance to kind of track into the macula or cause epiretinal membrane and such. And interestingly, I think they do say something where, you know, there's no reference to it, but in patients with these heavy oil tamponades, the PVR tends to actually develop above the horizontal meridian rather than below the horizontal meridian, which does give support to this idea of, like, kind of dependent PVR PVR stimulants. Anyway, so there again, as you mentioned, Jay, none of these are, I think, approved for use in the United States, but there's two types that are used frequently. One is called Oxane HD from Bausch & Lomb. The other one's called Densitron. These are all either mixtures of various types of oils with 5,000 centistoke oil. and again, or 5,700 centisilicone oil. And essentially what this paper then goes through is they talk about their experience with 49 patients using heavy silicone oil in PVR detachments for their second operation. And they suggest they had about a 60% reattachment rate after the first surgery, with 80% overall final reattachment rate, which is they say is a little bit worse than what's been reported in the literature, but I think in general sounds like to be not a bad outcome. They do note again complications with heavy silicone oil, things like prolonged intraocular pressure or inflammation, which can occur, which may be actually occur at a higher frequency than it does with other silicone oils. And they do note some of those in their case series as well. The last thing that they mentioned, which can be somewhat relevant to United States physicians, is this idea of short-term tamponade with perfluorocarbon. So as we know, we do use perfluorocarbon, which is also you can put in this heavy oil category. And, you know, potentially we know that we can't keep this in permanently, but, you know, can a short-term tamponade with perfluorocarbon also be utilized as a tamponade? And so they talk about 12 patients they did in case of a short-term tamponade with perfluorocarbon. This is after recurrent inferior RD that had previously treated with a buckle. And they talk about the reattachment rates about 70%. And so I think that is also an interesting thing that could be applied. And I've seen some of my colleagues do is to put in a short-term perfluorocarbon tamponade. I know Steve Charles advocates it. And I think that's also kind of an interesting point for discussion in terms of the pros and cons of that as well.
You know, Ali, you've written a decent number of articles reviewing PVR strategies. And you've done a couple studies. You did one at Wills with Avastin for PVR. One of the interesting things they talked about that Dan referenced was displacing the PVR by using heavy oil, that you don't necessarily get rid of it, but you just kind of move it. I mean, what are your thoughts on mm-hmm. that? You know, because that's one of the things people say, man, if we had those heavy oils, we wouldn't be getting all these inferior PVR. Do you think there are advantages to displacing it? Or do you think that, it sounds like you're just moving the problem somewhere else. Maybe if it's superior, maybe it's even a bigger issue because now you have gravity working against you in case you get a stretch break or something. I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the overall idea is that small fluid meniscus maybe collects all the cytokines or, you know, PVR promoting factors, and that's why you get PVR. So the point of the heavy silicone oils was to sort of help prevent that from happening inferiorly, but there always has to be some degree of a meniscus somewhere. And when using the heavy oils in the studies that they did in the mid-2000s, just noted that the PVR happened superiorly. I don't know if there is necessarily a benefit per se to that. You know, the studies that evaluated these were relatively small. The number of those PVR cases that moved superiorly wasn't like a statistically significant high-powered study that showed this. And essentially, you just move the retinectomy superior, which, like you said, Jay, you know, may not actually be a benefit given gravity. So, you know, the studies that first looked at heavy silicone oils were in the mid-2000s. They weren't that large. And this, the article mentioned this, there was no, you know, difference in PVR rates, you know, postoperatively using the heavy silicone oils versus, you know, the regular silicone oils. So there wasn't a benefit found. I think that's why the use of silicone oils fell off. So in the U.S. maybe now is sort of coming back in Europe, which is where this article comes into play. So I do think there's something to that fluid meniscus being the place where PVR happens, moving it from one side to another. I don't know if that really is going to make a huge clinical impact if the retina redetaches again. So to me, you know, if there was a difference in actual redetachment rates, I think that's what would push me to use these. And thus far, there hasn't been a study big enough to really show that.
Yeah. And my question again, and this is just, you know, there's not enough studies to address this, but it'd be an interesting thought exercise if we had everything available. You know, if you use silicone oil for a PVR detachment and then they got PVR and you did an inferior retinectomy and you put heavy oil in, and now that retinectomy is better covered, but would you just, again, displace the PVR, would you end up just moving your problem, or is it for a specific patient the problem then going to be localized to one area now you've supported it, right? Like, I don't know. That within an individual patient, it would be interesting to see if maybe certain patients do better with one or the other, or maybe in every patient, gravity is ultimately the decider. We just don't have that data. But again, it would be nice if we could get these approved just to have more options. It's, I think all of us would agree having more options is never a bad thing. So any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think
thoughts?
That's why this No, I think it's great that the group from Florence, you know, Dr. Rizzo's group is doing this and actually, you know, reporting their results before publishing. I think, like you said, Jay, it is helpful to know if any of this stuff would work, because PVR we still don't have an answer for. So, you know, if something could help, might as well try it.
Well, something else that's hard to find answers for is very high myopia when it comes to macular hole detachments, myopic foveoschisis, and myopic foveoschisis with macular holes. And so the next article is entitled Macular Buckling Technique with High Myopia, Back to the Future, by Alcabas and Carlos Mateo. Ali, you just want to tell us briefly about what they described, and we can just talk briefly about macular buckling. Dr. Murrow was on recently talking about macular buckling, but we can kind of mention our thoughts or experiences. Ali, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically the authors, you know, did a review of basically all studies that had outcomes reported for macular buckling in patients with high myopia, specifically with the posterior staphyloma, and they actually split up the references based on the specific subtype of posterior segment disease they had. So they distinguished these as, you know, myopic foveoschisis with or without foveal detachment. Also macular hole-based retinal detachment. So they did do a good job of trying to separate out the studies to give a better picture of the specific clinical scenario. And basically, they just reviewed the result of all of those studies, as well as give their opinion on, you know, whether this technique should be used alone or potentially in combination with vitrectomy, and ultimately advocated for kind of a renewed use of these techniques for the specific patient population.
Dan, what, did you have exposure to macular buckling at all at UCSF or any of your mentors?
You know, it was interesting. We did not, but we did kind of, there were some patients that we were considering doing it. And so there was no one that was actually doing active macular buckling at UCSF. Though there was one of our retina colleagues, Brian Ward, I think, who has done actually a fair amount of macular buckling. He's a little bit south in Campbell, California. He's actually reported his results in Retina. He's actually been doing macular buckling not so much for high myopic detachments or myopic macular hole detachment, but actually more just as a prophylaxis for prevention for increased myopia in high-risk patients. So what he's done, and I think he's had a couple of publications, right, where he does a macular buckle in patients with actually fairly good vision, no retinal detachment, no macular hole, but essentially puts it around this macular sling to hopefully prevent axial length elongation for the future, with the thought that, you know, if we look at the natural history of myopic macular degeneration, over time, you know, these patients will progressively lose vision that's really irreversible. And the idea is, like, can we prevent that? So it's definitely a kind of a very intriguing topic. You know, I think definitely for these either myopic macular hole detachments or myopic foveoschisis, you know, these I find are like very difficult cases to actually treat well and improve vision. And I think also maintaining a healthy kind of risk benefit ratio, I tend to be fairly conservative in terms of deciding whether to operate on them, just because of the high myopia, they're just at higher risk for complications. And as someone who's is not that familiar in terms of actually performing a lot of macular buckles, that would just increase, you know, that risk profile even higher in this already high risk population for me personally. But I think it makes a lot of sense intuitively. And I think hopefully as we're able to standardize, make this surgery easier and scalable, I think it's definitely something that deserves further study.
Ollie, any thoughts, final thoughts from you?
No, I mean, reading it kind of made me a little uncomfortable in the fact that I haven't really done any of these cases, and, you know, personally don't want to do too many of these cases if I can help it based on reading this article. So they talked about the article about how a lot of the studies, you know, people made, you know, homemade buckles for this purpose and all this stuff. Like, you know, I just thought to myself, that's not where I'm at right now in my skill set and where I train. So I give them kudos for kind of reviewing. I think they reviewed 31 articles. So, you know, all of the series are small. So putting them all together to kind of give a general picture was, I thought, super helpful. But again, I still feel pretty uncomfortable, you know, with this overall idea. They even mentioned, you know, this kind of suprachoroidal injection of viscoelastic that's been, you know, mentioned by authors previously might even be a better option because it's, you know, temporary. But that's another technique where, you know, I'm going to need to watch a million videos before I ever feel comfortable, you know, doing something like that. But, you know, surprisingly, the complication rates that they noted in this article from all those 31 papers were actually pretty low. You know, scleral perforation or something like that was only 1.4%. They wrote, and they only had to remove the macular buckles in only 2% of about 489 cases, which I thought was actually pretty impressive. I would have expected it to be higher given how complicated it seems. But yeah, I'm glad they did it. And again, I need to watch a lot of videos before I think I'd try this on my own.
I'm not going to elaborate or belabor this too much. I agree with everything you said, both in principle and in the emotion and thought behind it. So I am totally on board with what you said, because I don't think my garage is ready for me to start making macular buckles. I don't even have a garage. I live in a condo. So so we're going to move on. The last one is called suprachoroidal injection of triamcinolone acetonide for macular edema and retinal vein occlusion. Subtitle, a therapy with potential to boost anti-VEGF efficacy. This is by Mark Bearcat out from Arizona. And Dan, you just want to tell us briefly about what they're talking about here and Clearside, and then we can just discuss briefly. These are phase two results that were summarized here, but and then the technique. So your thoughts, Dan,
sure,
to start.
Absolutely. Yeah, so just as a disclosure, I actually am our site PI for UCSD for the SAPPHIRE study. So I do get funding from Clearside to do the trial. And, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with the technology. So this is, I think, a really promising platform technology. So the idea is that I think what this group observed, I think Henry Edelhauser at Emory back in the day when they injected into the suprachoroidal space, they found that drugs tended to stay around for a long time. And also, if you look at the pharmacokinetics of drugs, the concentration is very high in the choroid and in the retina, but then rapidly drops off as you get closer to the anterior chamber. And I think, you know, based on this data, this gave the idea of, like, you know, perhaps if we, perhaps led to this idea of perhaps we can use this suprachoroidal space as a potential drug reservoir to keep drugs around there longer that potentially may have very high concentrations in the posterior segment while avoiding anterior segment complications. And that is the rationale behind Clearside using this preservative-free triamcinolone formulation for suprachoroidal injection. So essentially what they've developed is they've developed a couple of these suprachoroidal needles, which measure either 900 microns or 1100 microns. And the idea is that that this injector, essentially, it's a two-handed injection technique where you'll go ahead and dimple it about perpendicular to the sclera, and then you'll basically push down onto the plunger. And then when you're in the suprachoroidal space, it's actually nice in that you don't get a resistance to the flow versus when you are not in the suprachoroidal space, you know, you're just not able to inject because of the scleral resistance. And having done a couple of these, like it's not that difficult, and it is actually, you know, it's pretty, as you can tell, like when you're in the suprachoroidal space versus, and you can't really inject it into the sclera. And I have yet to inject it intravitreally. I don't think that has been a reported complication in the trials. And so the report on they've actually been testing this for a number of indications. They actually have finished phase three studies with this suprachoroidal triamcinolone in CME for uveitis with positive results. They report in this article about the Tanzanite trial, which is a phase two study of 46 patients for retinal vein occlusion. Essentially, they found that they did it in combination with aflibercept and found that there was a decreased need for retreatment with aflibercept in the combination group versus aflibercept alone with minimal, you know, the interesting thing is looking at the complication profile. And so I think about a couple of patients, maybe two of them had intraocular hypertension that could be controlled with topical drops. There's another phase 1-2 study, the Hulk study that was done in DME, where they injected I think treatment naive patients with DME with through injections of the suprachoroidal triamcinolone, and again had good results that seemed fairly durable with not too much with I think just a couple patients that might have had increased intraocular pressure. And so now they're kind of moving forward on all fronts. The SAPPHIRE trial, which is the phase 3 trial in patients with both central retinal vein occlusion as well as branch retinal vein occlusion, is comparing this suprachoroidal triamcinolone with aflibercept compared to aflibercept alone. And that trial is actually now finished enrollment, and hopefully the results we'll hear, you know, sometime soon in the next year. But I think it's a really exciting, you know, and you can imagine this could be done for other types of things, but the idea of having, you know, kind of a longer reservoir as well as high concentration in the retina but less concentration in the lens is very attractive. And I think some of that clinical data is starting to reflect that there does seem to be less anterior segment complications with this type of delivery of steroids versus conventional techniques. But I think we're kind of waiting to see the final results.
Ali, any thoughts, and if you have any disclosure, you can mention them as well, but any thoughts on either delivery technique or the results that they described here?
No disclosure. Shout out to Dan for excellent disclosure before he gave his summary. But I think this was actually a great summary of the Tanzanite study that looked at, you know, suprachoroidal injection with aflibercept or without for RVO. And, you know, kind of as we expect, the, you know, anatomic outcomes were actually better with additional steroids, but also vision seemed to be better with less anterior segment side effects. So, you know, with that sort of a result profile, I certainly would be willing to use it when it, you know, is formally approved. You know, I would have some questions about, you know, anesthesia. Can you, you know, repeat this type of injection in the same general area or not over time? Does that have any effect? So I think all those things will be borne out in the future. But, you know, I've done the technique kind of in a wet lab setting, and it seemed relatively simple. I know Aaron on Civilingam at Wills was kind of involved in the earlier studies, and he was kind of showing us the technique. But if the results look as good as the results seem to be from Dr. Barakat's article here, I think certainly this will get traction moving forward.
And thinking way ahead, I mean, the other things that would be important, but obviously efficacy and how good it is for our patients would be, number one, would be costs, insurance coverage, you know, like you said, can you deliver to the same area multiple times? And then ultimately the results will kind of dictate what sort of treatment strategies we'll take with this and how it will be incorporated into our algorithm when seeing patients as BRVO and or CRVO, depending whether the results are different between those two. Well, Dan, Ali, thank you again for doing this, these quick summaries and this discussion with me. I really appreciate it. I know you guys are both busy this summer, so kudos to both of you. Shout out to Zain Khan, Ali's son, who is now how many weeks? 10 weeks?
10 weeks old, yep.
10 wow. weeks old.
Still and getting bigger by the week, so looks like a real baby now, yeah.
Well, and don't forget about your other babies, the Los Angeles Lakers, who are filled with young talent but no stars. It will be an interesting draft night tomorrow night.
It's going to be a big summer for the Lakers, Jay. Just letting you know, big summer.
I went on the record on the podcast and I said, I think it's going to be, I think Kawhi, LeBron, PG-13. All to the Lakers this summer. That's my guess. If I had to put money down with odds, that would be my guess for the Lakers.
Well, you know what? There was an interesting article by Michael Wilbon, how he was actually saying that Washington D.C. would be the best place for LeBron for having in his, you know, because it's
totally unbiased.
Capital, you know,
totally unbiased.
Not biased, but just pointing that out.
I read that
dream.
Same
People
article.
Dan.
It was 100% biased. And it's not. It's going to be the Lakers.
Dan, it's like this is like Ajay talking about. At least Ajay has the sense not to talk about LeBron to the Knicks. I mean, the Wizards. I don't even know where you'd start. Though there were rumors about. I did see an article about Bradley Beal for Kevin Love and the number 8 pick being discussed. So that would be a terrible trade for the Wizards and an awesome trade for the Cavs. But that has been discussed. Beal would be a great second banana with LeBron. But I don't think he's staying in Cleveland. I'd be very surprised.
We shall see.
Well, fellas, enjoy your summer. I will see you hopefully both later this summer in ASRS. And otherwise, have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, you too, Jay. Thanks again.
Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's